As I said earlier, this morning we're going to make a new start on a new teaching series. Over the next number of weeks, we're going to start working through the book of Ecclesiastes. Some of us may never have read it. It is not necessarily a go-to popular book. Maybe it's a bit neglected. But even if you haven't read it, you're sure to be familiar with some of the words. The 1960s band, The Birds, popularized some of the verses in their song, Turn, Turn, Turn. Don't make me sing it. I might actually. And actually, I think they may have covered that after someone else, but you know the song, you know the lines. I'm talking about, for every season, turn. Come on, join me in this. Time to be. I'm not okay. A time to die. I all lifted directly from Ecclesiastes. Or perhaps you've heard the optimist quoted verse, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's another famous verse from this book we're about to study, albeit, as I said, misquoted. Or maybe you've been at a wedding and heard the verse, this happens at my wedding, a cord of three strands is not easily broken. Or how about there is nothing new under the sun? Another famous quote from this book. We are perhaps more familiar with some of the content than we think we are. Now, Ecclesiastes is an ancient book. It sits in the middle of the Bible within what we call the wisdom literature. This is a wee category of books within the scripture. It includes the book of Job, Song of Songs, Psalms, Proverbs, and of course Ecclesiastes, five books. And these books are called the wisdom books because they are all about life. They're all about the big questions of life. They cover our relationships, suffering, success in life, evil in the world, pleasure, walking with God, friends, family, finances. They are personal, pastoral books. And they talk to us about living in a wise and godly way. Now, Ecclesiastes itself was written about 1,000 years before Jesus was born. As I said, it is really old, it's ancient. And actually this means that it actually predates philosophers like Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates. Those famous, celebrated philosophers are actually latecomers to the arena of philosophy and wisdom compared to the author of Ecclesiastes. But who was the author of Ecclesiastes? Well, as always, there's a bit of debate about this. But the answer here is simple because the author introduces himself to us in the first words of the book. He says, these are the words of the teacher, the king of Israel, the son of David. Now this word teacher could also be translated as preacher or churchman. The Hebrew word is koheleth, and it's a word used to describe someone who addresses an assembly. Normally a religious assembly. Hence the translation of preacher. And even the title of this book reflects this in Ecclesiastes. Is obviously where we get our word ecclesiastical from. Meaning church. So the title of the book literally means the congregation. So we have the teacher speaking to the congregation. And as to the identity of the teacher, well, he is the king of Israel, the son of David. Now, if we take this introduction and put it together with what the teacher says later about himself, then we have one obvious answer. The author of Ecclesiastes is King Solomon. The Bible tells us a whole lot about King Solomon. We know that he was King David's son from his marriage with Bathsheba. She was, of course, the wife that David stole from Uriah. And then he arranged that so Uriah would die on the battlefield so that he could cover up his adultery. And we know that it was Solomon and not David who was given the honour and privilege of building God's temple. When Solomon became king, the Lord appeared to him in a dream and asked him to request any one thing that he wanted. And Solomon, he didn't ask for wealth, he didn't ask for fame, instead he asked for wisdom. Wisdom so that he could rule God's people well. And God was so pleased with the purity of heart and the selflessness that Solomon demonstrated in that request that he granted Solomon's desire for wisdom, and he also granted him all the wealth and fame that anyone could ask for. So Solomon probably was the wisest man who has ever lived and ever will live except for Jesus. He had a supernatural wisdom granted to him by God. He was of royal descent, and at that time Israel was in its glory years. It was one of the most powerful, affluent, influential nations in the known world. And so he also had the best educational opportunities open to man. He had huge wealth. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now it's coming up to Valentine's Day. Some of us are wondering what to do with our one wife. Never mind how Solomon managed his 1,000 women. One of the commentators I was reading says that if you combine Bill Gates, Stephen Hawking and Hugh Hefner into one person, and then for that person to be simultaneously the Pope and the President, then you have a bit of an idea who Solomon was. He wrote 3,000 proverbs, 1,005 songs, and 3 books of the Bible. He reigned over this powerful nation for 40 years, and Israel experienced unparalleled peace and prosperity during this time. Now, Solomon's story is maybe a bit like the prodigal. He was born to a father who loved the Lord. David would have instructed him and brought him up to seek and to know God. But at some point, Solomon went his own way. He rejected the Lord and he went chasing after his own agenda, his own passions. But then the fact that he wrote Ecclesiastes, I think, is proof. At some point, he returned to the Lord and to the faith of his father. Maybe even towards the end of his life. I suppose we'll just have to wait and see as we journey through the book. Now, there's only some evidence at this point of view, but I think Solomon wrote Song of Songs when he was a young man, first married. I think he wrote the book of Proverbs throughout his life, and then Ecclesiastes in his twilight years. As I said, we can't know that for definite, but as you read those books, it makes a lot of sense. Now, some of you might like to watch a TV film or a program with a bit of a twist. Put your hand up if you like to watch one of those programs. Yes, don't see it coming. Maybe you like those mystery dramas that you keep tuning in, week in, week out, so that you can watch the story gradually unfold. If that's you, I am sorry to disappoint. Ecclesiastes is not like that. There is no twist, there's no big surprise, there's no hidden agenda. Right from the very first chapter, Solomon is open and he's frank about the message that he has to share with us. He is debating that age-old question that teenagers, philosophers, musicians, and sages alike have tried to tackle since the beginning of time. What is life all about? What is the meaning of life? Is this really all there is? That's the big central linchpin of Ecclesiastes. How do I live a life that means anything? And at first glance, the teacher, Solomon, seems to be a bit bleak and pessimistic about all this. There's 3 main themes of this chapter that I'm going to draw out briefly for you this morning. We're not going to delve into these ideas deeply this morning. These are the thoughts that we will see repeated throughout the 11 chapters that follow this one. And so we'll have lots of opportunity to look at them later. But there are 3 important things that Solomon is struggling with as we meet them in the first chapter. The first big issue is the meaninglessness of life. The opening lines say, meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. Now this word, NIV, translated as meaningless, is a tricky wee word. Some other versions of the Bible translate it as vanity, as in everything is in vain. Others translate it as vapor, something fleeting, short-lived, there one day, gone the next, like something you continually try to grasp for in your hand, but you never seem to manage to catch it. It's like one of those flies. Can't get it. That's how someone feels about life. All of life. Work is meaningless. You get up in the morning, you go to work, then the next day you have to do it all over again. You cut your grass, you come back a few days later, and guess what? It has grown. You have to do it again. You stand at your ironing board, not me, stand at your ironing board to empty your ironing basket. The washing machine stops, and before you know it, it is full again. In Solomon's eyes, work is meaningless. You gain nothing. You earn money to spend it, and then you have to earn it again. It's meaningless. What about marriage? Meaningless. What about pleasure? Meaningless. What about wealth? Meaningless. It's all meaningless. Now, I don't know if you saw it or not. There's a program on Channel 4 on Thursday, and then I think it was when I came in. It was about a couple who achieved great success in London, in the city of London, or some sort of business. They earned lots of money, but it didn't satisfy. They fulfilled all their ambitions, and it realized that it meant nothing. And so they completely relocated their lives into the Yukon Territory in Canada. Together they were living a completely isolated existence, hunting for moose, chopping firewood, and living off the land. They were looking for a life of meaning. They had tried one way, now they were going to try another. In chapter 1, Solomon tells us that he has done this. If you have your Bibles open, look at verse 13 and 14. Solomon says, I have done it all. I have seen it all. Everything that happens under the sun, any way you can think of living your life, I have been there. I've explored, I've experimented. It's all meaningless. It's all like chasing after the wind. You never get what you are looking for. You reach out your hand to grasp and it falls through your fingers. Now we've seen two very sad examples of that in recent weeks in the media, with George Michael and Tara Palmer Tomkinson. Two individuals by the world standards look to have everything, but it didn't satisfy. And so from what the media says, they looked for comfort and satisfaction in drugs. And as we know now, for them, it had a tragic end. That's Solomon's point here. There's nothing you or anyone has to teach me. I've seen and done everything. You can try drugs, wealth, sex, work, even wisdom itself, and it's all meaningless. There is an uplifting message for you this morning. Now, as we work through chapter 1, we find the reason Solomon says this. And again, it's another thing that we're likely to come across in the coming weeks. He says, this life is fleeting. The generations, they come and go, and nothing ever changes. We never make a difference. The earth just carries on, though we had never been here. In fact, he says, no one even remembers the ancestors that have gone before them, and how little difference we would make to the world. We don't even leave a footprint. Sometimes we get to thinking, us humans, we progress. That we are cleverer. That we have more insight. That we are more advanced than the primitive people who have gone before us. But according to Ecclesiastes, the truth is, we live more in a circle than in a line that progresses out. Future generations just cover the same ground that the previous one did. We ask the same questions. We ask them in different ways. We fight the same wars just with different weapons. We try to outdo one another in the same ways. We work the same land for the same results. We just use different methods. different machinery. Yes, we move, but we don't necessarily progress. Now, you may be listening to all of this, and you may be thinking, sure, that's just nonsense. Look at all we have achieved. We go to the moon. We know so much more about the universe and our Earth. Solomon would ask you, to what end? What good has it done? What meaning does it really have? Or you may say, look at our progress in education and medical science. And I would agree that these are good and great things that we benefit from. But do they represent progress, or is it just movement? After all, we learn to cure disease after disease. Again, a great thing. But we just die of something else in the end anyway. According to Ecclesiastes, we live our short lives that are nothing more than a whip or a vapor, and then we leave this earth and we barely even make a mark. The sun still rises and sets. The wind, as you can hear, still blows. And the rivers, well, they still flow. If you have a child in primary school, you may have noticed this week's fact on the back of your blue newsletter this week. It was discovered by Kane and P5. It says, there is still the same amount of water on planet Earth now as there was in the beginning. It hasn't changed. And that sums up what Solomon is saying here in verse 7. What difference do you really make? All too soon, you'll be forgotten. And you know there's a sad truth in that. How many of us here know the names of our great, great, great grandparents? Sadly, not very many of us. And relatively speaking, they lived not long ago. Now, these are painful, they're brutal words that this book starts off with. However you've lived your life, whatever you've invested your time in, it's all meaningless. It's all been done before, and it will be done again. You'd honestly be forgiven for thinking that this is a bit dismal. And that Solomon, what Solomon actually needed was really a cup of tea and a hug. But that brings us to our final theme for this morning. There is nothing new under the sun. Like it says in verse 9, everything has been done before and it will be done again. You see that with things like fashion, don't you? Some of you older men in here look at brogues and skinny ties that are around at the minute and realise that you recognise that style from a day gone by. The ladies are the same. The cut of the dress is reminiscent of something you recall from decades ago. It's the same with music or food, or with the resurgence we're seeing in the interest in old trades and crafts. There is nothing new under the sun. Now, if you're following with me, you'll see in verse 10 that many people say, okay, here's something new. But all that is a distraction. All that is an attempt to deny that we do all in fact live in this rut or this cycle, one generation after the other, perpetrating the same things over and over again. And you know, sometimes we can see that in our own lives. A new haircut, a new car. I'm not happy with any haircuts, by the way. A new haircut, a new car, a new house that will completely change our lives. That will make all the difference. But does it really? And sometimes we see it in the media. If you're stuck in a rut, if you're trapped in the humdrum of life, well, maybe you need God plan to get you a new wardrobe. Maybe you need to speak to Kirsty and Phil to get you a new house. Or Michael Mosley to give you a new diet. At the end of the day, all that stuff really is just chasing after the wind. Someone asked me a really interesting question last week. Someone from the church, he asked me, why don't you just stick to the easy bits in the Bible? Why do you not just avoid the hard bits? The question took me by surprise. I can't even really remember how I answered him. Now, there's lots of answers to this question about why I don't cherry pick through the nice bits of Scripture. Firstly, because we need a full picture of the whole character and nature of God. But secondly, here's the thing that's relevant for us this morning. I don't just pick through the nice bits because the Bible is absolutely, completely, and totally honest about what it is like to live in a broken world, post-Genesis 3 world. And the truth is, it's hard. The Bible does not shrink from that. It doesn't try to dress that up. If this book was trying to sell you some false promise of a better life, some false religion, would it be so brutally honest? But where is the hope in all of this? What are we to take away from this? That there's no point going on? No, not at all. There must be hope. Anyone who's ever been involved in a survival situation knows that you can be a Bear Grylls type character, you can have all the survival skills and knowledge at the end of the day, but one thing that you have to carry on is hope. And Solomon gives it here. Admittedly, you have to look for it. You have to look hard for it. But it's there. It comes in this phrase, under the sun. That's a phrase that will recur about 30 times. Everything is meaningless under the sun. But what about beyond the sun? What about above the sun? Can hope be found there? God hardly gets a mention in chapter 1 at all. But he is almost there by his absence throughout it. After all the brooding, the brutal honesty of the preacher, we are hungry for hope. We are hungry for the antidote to this meaningless life. And where do we have to look for it? Not under the sun, but above the sun. Above the sun where God resides. Above the sun where his hand is over and in and through all things. Above the sun where he promises the faithful, those who live this life for him, that there is great final reward. And maybe it's the great reward that will mean that this meaningless life is not so meaningless after all. It's this great reward that will mean that this meaningless life is not meaningless after all.